Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace. This is another Future State Friday episode. We're up to week six, and all I can say is thank God, because we're that much closer to the end. I love DC. You know I'm a DC guy, and I want to like these books, and it's the reason that I pre-ordered all of them. I was even talking about my wife, who doesn't like comics at all, has tried, but just it's not her thing. So I was telling her I had this giant stack of books. I was cleaning my offices. We got a giant stack, all the Future State stuff. And it's a huge stack because not only did I go all in and get all the issues, some of them I got multiple covers because I couldn't choose, which normally I don't do. Normally I force myself to choose a cover. Like there's got to be a cover that you like more than another. Part of the reason for this was that I ordered one cover or another, and then DC had, they kept delaying their Wonder Woman 1984 covers. And they said, oh, we're going to drop them as Future State alternates. And there were some, so, and I didn't know that. And I'd already ordered the other cover. So now I'm ending up with multiples. And it's just this giant stack of books. And I sent it over to the two guys that are joining me today, as they have generously with their time for every Future State episode. Trevor from Dark Knight Nation and Rocky from Comic Boom. And I sent them, a picture. And I said, you know what? Looking at this makes me sick. Because it's so much wasted money. And I'm not made of money to where I could just be throwing it away. I could have spent this money on back issues or some other indie comics. And it's, I kind of felt really felt the retailer pain of when they have to order stuff sight unseen. I had no idea what the quality of Future State was going to be. It could have been great. I could have been super excited about it. So I order it not having any idea who most of the creators are. And knowing who some of the artists are and thinking that it was going to be, great work from artists who I've come to trust, like Eddie Barrows and whatnot. And it wasn't that. And I don't know. It just makes me, I feel a little bit cheated. I'm a little angry with DC. Like next time they have a big event, why should I bother to support it? I was looking just out of curiosity at some of the other big events that they did, especially when they started the New 52. I'm sure you guys remember this. Every September, they do a big thing. Like it was one September, it was all the zero issues, and another September, it was like all the villain lenticular variants, and then another September, it was was it Future's End, right?
Yeah.
I'm like, man, if I go on eBay right now, I could buy all those issues for cover price or less if I buy them, as a big lot. So. I mean, granted, I spent less than that because I ordered these from DCBS, months in advance, and I got my 40 or 50% off or whatever. But still, it's hundreds of dollars, and it's just garbage. And yeah. I don't know, it makes me mad. I know, Trevor, for you, it seems like it more than makes you angry. It seems like it depresses you.
Yeah, that's a perfectly great diagnosis of how I'm feeling reading this week to week. And what disappoints me more is that, I am a huge supporter of new voices, of people that you haven't heard in the industry before, giving them their time to tell their stories. And, we kind of half-assedly get that here. And, they are new voices, but there's a caveat. None of them are actually from comics. Because of whatever reason, DC feels it appropriate to maybe work into the contract of their writers and animation to come in and do their cheap entertainment here. And it shows. It's disappointing. It saddens me to not want to support what was my favorite comic book publisher. I said it last week, congratulations, DC. You gave the best publisher in the industry award, or my favorite publisher in the industry award, to Image Comics. So,
yeah, you usually try to hold that DC flag high, Rocky, and I applaud you for that. And I kind of feel the same way. A lot of times I defend DC against Marvel and others and say, man, it's you're being too harsh on them. You there's a double standard. Marvel gets away with something, and then DC does it, and they get called out for it. But in my mind, this stuff's hard to defend. What are you thinking?
Well, it is hard to defend, although I suppose if Donald Trump can get acquitted, I'm certainly up to task to defend DC Comics.
not to bring politics into this, but I just had to throw that in there because I'm pissed off about that too. But in any event, the reality is that I do think that DC put themselves into a corner with Future State. I think they had to truncate the stories. And that would be the only defense I could come up with for some of these confusing, convoluted stories in terms of why they're so badly put together, both sometimes horribly artistically and certainly narratively. A lot of them are a mess. Some of them are good, but most of them are pretty bad and not up to the standards that I was already disappointed with going into Future State. And so I'm just sort of like heartbroken right now, because it really does seem like what DC is headed in the wrong direction. And it's particularly disappointing to me when I get to the end of some of these Future State stories that we're going to talk about, where they actually end by saying, do you want to know how we get here? Come back in March and we're going to start a 1 or 2 year tale, and we can tell you how we got to Future State, which is the last goddamn thing that we want. That is the worst advertising in the world to get people to come back in March, is this convoluted narrative of Future State. This was somebody, I mean, if this was any other business, somebody honestly should be fired over this. I mean, editorially, this is really, really, really bad. I mean, again, I'll try to put some lipstick on the pig when we talk about these titles, but you'll understand that I'm doing precisely that.
Yeah, and I agree with you. I mean, okay, nobody held a gun to my head and made me go in on Future State. I wanted to support DC. I wanted to support the new voices. That was my decision. You know, I accept that. But I don't want anything to do with Future State. And now you're telling me that a lot of these stories, to Rocky's point, aren't ending. Come back, find out how we got here. Go read Future State Gotham for more of this. Why would I want any more of this? This is not good. And as far, I mean, I do agree that DC editorial does share some of the blame for this, but also, and again, I say it all the time, no creator starts out by saying, I'm going to make a mediocre comic. They're trying to make good comics. The problem is they're just not succeeding. And so as much as we lay the blame at the feet of DC editorial for making suspect decisions, because they had to approve these pitches or whatever, the people got to execute also. You know, it's like a sports team, right? You do hold the coach accountable when things are a mess, but also the players have to go out and perform. These creators got to go out and perform. You know, it's a different situation for the artist, maybe if they're really rushed and didn't have enough time. You know, you kind of can let that slide a little bit. And maybe you can give a little bit of slack to the writers as well if they were rushed. But then, you know, at the end of the day, if you're a writer and you're offered something and you don't have time to do it, it's up to you to say, hey, I don't have time to do it. Because the bottom line is these books just aren't very good. So let's stop talking about how they're not very good and start talking about them specifically, I guess. How they're
how they're specifically not good.
Yeah. So we'll start with Robin a Turtle Part 2. And this one particularly had me disappointed because the writer, Megan Fitzsimmons, I thought the first issue had showed promise. It's Eddie Barrow's pencils. I talked extensively about the first issue about how it wasn't up to his normal standards, even though he had his normal inker, Ibar Ferreira, who was my inker of the year for 2020, Adriana Lucas on colors, Pat Brousseau on letters. This is a team I expect great things from visually, and it wasn't up to task. I do think that the second issue is a little closer to the level that I expect from Eddie Barrow's, but still not all the way there. I mean, for me, I guess just because I love the art and the visuals in Freedom Fighters, that 12 issue maxi series that Robert Venditti wrote, to me, that's some of Eddie Barrow's best work. So in my mind, every time I see Eddie Barrow's work now, I'm always comparing it to that. And maybe that's not fair that I'm always expecting him to put out his absolute best work. But again, this was better visually than the first issue. It's still dynamic. I cannot fault Eddie Barrow's at all in the first or the second issue in the angles he chooses to take in the way he visually chooses to tell the story. There's scenes that, you know, where Robin's falling that are great, where, you know, he's literally upside down and the camera angles and all that kind of stuff. It's very dynamic. He's breaking panels sometimes. He's using interesting page layout. So visually, I enjoyed it. It was, you know, 90% there for me in terms of Eddie. If anything, I just thought sometimes the sort of the texture and the rendering weren't quite up to what I usually expect from. Just wasn't as clean as I expect from Eddie. But again, it was a little nitpick. As far as the story, again, the reason this was so disappointing for me is because I thought that the first issue, it showed promise. And then when it comes to quote unquote ending it, again, like a lot of them, it doesn't really end because we're going to get that Future State Gotham title. So there's so much left up in the air. And it was almost like what I liked about the first issue was it focused on Tim Drake and it was fun and it felt like a Tim Drake story and it didn't take itself too seriously. And then in this one, it's like Megan Fitzsimmons decides, well, there wasn't enough, I don't know, emotional impact in the first one. It wasn't deep enough. And I felt like she tried to kind of dive into that a little too much, especially with the narration. So I don't know. It was a miss for me. It's certainly not the worst book of the week by any stretch of the imagination, but it really ended on a flat note for me, especially because, right, I mean, like I said, it doesn't really end. In fact, the last page says not the end. So to Rocky's point earlier, we're supposed to come back for more of this crap. Not me. It was a disappointment because the first issue actually ended up being the better of the two. And that one was flawed as well. So what did you think about this one, Trevor?
I actually thought the art was significantly worse in this issue than it was in the last issue. Mm-hmm. As you were speaking, I just counted. There are 40 panels without backgrounds. 40. 40 panels without backgrounds. And I love Eddie Barrows. I will die on my sword and say that Eddie Barrows is the most underrated artist in comics. I own pages by him. I am a huge fan of his. So, you know, anybody listening to this, this isn't anything against Eddie. I love the guy. I've met him. He's very sweet. This is very poorly done. Visually, everything feels super rigid. Like Jace had mentioned, the rendering, shadow quality, all of that is so scratchily done. You could tell that this book was rushed into oblivion. There are moments where, you know, you can tell him trying to compensate with kind of wild layouts. And if I felt like they were creatively inspired, at least I definitely would have given him the nod on that. But you can tell that it's primarily him trying to compensate for being rushed. So it's hard to totally blame him there. I guess, you know, he was trying to put lipstick on a pig as Rocky's been trying to do to the entire line. But, you know, there's only so much you can do. Story-wise, it was messy. You could tell that Fitzmartin was really desperately trying to inject this with a little bit more weight, but honestly fails miserably. It felt like a first-time writer. And I don't care what anybody says, it wasn't learning the format of comics. This is narratively poor. On a basic storytelling level, it was narratively and emotionally poor. I thought even like, honestly, after reading the first issue, I wouldn't have picked this one up, and this one's even worse. So, you know, it's really hard to say. The color work, you can tell that the colorist really, really tries to batten down the hatches, but it's difficult when you have so many pages with non-backgrounds. So you just kind of have to really saturate the color in between whatever texture the penciler or inker is throwing on there. It's a poorly put together book. It's a shame because I you know, when I heard a Tim Drake book with Eddie Barrows on art, I was actually relatively excited, but, you know, par for the course, DC Future State completely and utterly snuffs out any excitement that I have for their line. So,
yeah, it's going to be
an Eternal number two.
It's going to be interesting to see if any of these writers from other media, she's from TV, if you're not aware.
Yeah, she wrote that that new Justice Society of America movie, the World War II movie.
Yeah, yeah.
And she's one of the co-writers on that.
Yeah, she was also, I think, assistant showrunner or head writer or something like that on Supernatural for seasons. And that's a very popular show. But I was just going to say, it's going to be interesting to see if any of these, if they stick with it, if any of these writers from other media stick with comics and, you know, eventually put out some things that we like, it'd be
yeah. Interesting. Or hear me out. You could just grab people in indie that are making great books.
You could do that. Yeah, you could do that too. But
yeah, but that would be the smart decision. So clearly that's not in DC's repertoire.
Exactly. Yeah, I'm just wondering if any of these people will, I'll feel bad later and go, oh man, your early work was so tough and I was so hard on you, but now you put out something great. It just, I don't know, trying to be optimistic. What were your thoughts on Robin Eternal 2, Rocky?
Well, I'm going to, I actually really enjoyed the art. I'm not putting lipstick on the pig. I actually really enjoyed the art. I particularly compliment Pat Brousseau on the colors. The colors were really good. I didn't notice.
Sorry, Rocky. That's Adriana Lucas.
Adriana Lucas. Am I looking at the wrong?
Brousseau's a letterer. Yeah.
I'm sorry. Yeah. Thank you for the correction, Adriana Lucas. Yeah. The colors were really good, particularly because the colors is what you relied upon, because Tim Drake is hallucinating. He's having an impact. He's having a hallucinatory effect, or a mental breakdown, or some sort of anguish as a result of the Lazarus resin that he was covered with at the beginning, that ultimately saves his life because he was killed at the end, and it resurrects him and gives him extra strength. But it also tends to eliminate emotion. And there's some question as to whether or not the magistrates possibly using him as a guinea pig or not, because it hadn't really been tested. It hadn't really been tested on a human before. And so I thought that worked very well. I thought this worked. I enjoyed, I followed the story. This was out of all the stories, when I include all the backups of all the Future State stories that came out this week, including the backups, this is my, probably the, in ranking from best to worst, this is my fourth, I guess, best. There's three other stories that I like better, but I thought this worked. Actually, even the way this ended, it ended when it said not the end. It basically, this was an origin story for a new Tim Drake. He's now got superpowers. He's got enhanced strength. So this is the future of Tim Drake. Tim Drake is now different. They're trying to make Tim Drake not another nice Damien, because Drake was always kind of a nice Damien, right?
Don't tell me that.
Now, obviously they're giving him superpowers. He's got powers now as a result of this. And because they've destroyed all the resin at the end of this, he's the only one who's going to have who is extra powered like this because of the Lazarus resin. I'm assuming that Tim Drake is going to set him apart from other members of the Batman family now. I'm not saying that's necessarily a good thing for Tim Drake fans. I mean, they'll have to decide for themselves whether or not they like that. But clearly, in two issues, this is a new origin for Tim Drake. He's dead now. He's been dead and resurrected. And okay, now I don't know if they're going to undo Future State at some point, because you never know. I mean, because everything matters and nothing matters in this new DC universe. So who the hell knows? But for a two issue story, I actually thought that I felt that this did have a kind of an ending. It had a beginning, a middle, and an end. The plot line was resolved. They destroyed the Lazarus resin. Tim Drake's still alive, and he's got some enhanced strength, and he survives the fall into Gotham Harbor. And that's where we're at. And, you know, for what it was, for a two-issue story, I mean, okay, I realize I'm comparing it to other Future State stories, but it's not as bad as it's one of the better ones in my view.
Yeah, it's not as bad as it could be. You're right. Which is an extremely low bar. And I think Tim Drake always gets the shaft. Ever since Damian came along, Tim Drake gets the shaft in my mind. I can't stand Damian as a character, although he has gotten better over the years. I will admit that he's not as annoying to me as he was before. But in my mind, you know, to my mind, giving Tim Drake superpowers diminishes the character. Tim Drake's interesting enough with what he does and different enough with what he does that you should be able to write good Tim Drake stories without having to give him powers. That's a crutch in my mind. And I feel bad. Tim Drake's actually my favorite Robin. So anyway, let's move on to what's arguably, in my mind, the worst book of the week, which is Green Lantern. It's just, my God, where to start with this one? So it's written by Jeffrey, the main story, I should say, is written by Jeffrey Thorne, art by Tom Rainey. We've got colors by Mike Atea, letters by And World Design. Then we've got a backup story starring Teen Lantern that's written by Josie Campbell, art by Andy Tong, colors by Will Quintana, and letters by Dave Sharp. And then there's a second backup starring Hal Jordan that's written by Robert Venditti. The art in that one is handled by Dexter Soy, colors by Alex Sinclair, and letters by Steve Wands. Why don't you kick it off there, Rocky? What'd you think of Green Lantern?
My third favorite story. I'm going to focus on the positive. My third favorite story this week is the Teen Lantern. I'm going to start off with my favorite story because it's not the one by Jeffrey Thorne. It's the one by Josie Campbell, the Teen Lantern story. One of the things that Brian Michael Bendis did a horrible job with Young Justice is that we never really got to know any of the Young Justice members at all. He did a really bad job, particularly with Teen Lantern. We knew very little about Teen Lantern, whose real name is Kelly Quintella. And at least we got to know her a little bit more here. I would have liked more information, but I like the fact that this was really well done. I thought artist Andy Tong did a really good job of showing just the youth and the innocence of young Kelly Quintella, where she's facing sort of like the new guardians, and she puts her hand up to ask a question, and they're really curious about Krona's a gauntlet that's attached to her hand that doesn't seem to, they can't get it off. They tried to steal it from her when she slept, and they've tricked the energies from the gauntlet into a sector of the galaxy, and they're going to put her on Mogo, the Green Lantern planet, to travel to this new area of the galaxy to explore the new gauntlet. This is the type of story that I wanted to see in Young Justice. I would have loved all of Young Justice to go on that adventure. This actually got me kind of excited for Teen Lantern. And I think the story meandered a bit, unfortunately, but I think its strengths is that we got to know her fears. This is a young girl. This is a young girl, and she's fearful. And we were talking earlier, I guess, on direct messages, and Trevor made the point that, well, so she's not special. and of course, she isn't. She acquired this gauntlet purely by accident. And she's not, you know, she wasn't born special or anything like that. She's acquired this, and now suddenly she's got to step up to the plate and overcome her fears. And I'm hopeful that this is the beginning of what could be a really great character arc akin to Jessica Cruz's character arc that took many years to play out. But I think Jessica Cruz started off being very fearful and what have you. And she was an adult and this is a young teen, and how her character journey, I think, starts here as opposed to the pages of Young Justice. And I thought Josie Campbell did a really good job here. I really like the art. I also, Will Quintana, the colorist, I thought did a really good job on it as well. And I thought the story, I think it's interesting. They're going to be trapped now, and I guess in the darkness, and they're still trapped in space, but I'm kind of curious to see where it goes. Again, it ends. It doesn't end. It doesn't really have an ending. They're just sort of trapped in the void, and it says for 52 days and counting, but I have to admit it does get me curious. There's the Hal Jordan story with Robert Vendetti, with fantastic art. Dexter Soy, man, that artist, he's one of the best artists that DC has. Him and Eddie Burroughs, I think Dexter Soy gives Eddie Burroughs a run for his money. Fantastic artist. Does a great job here drawing Hal Jordan. And this is another story that sort of goes nowhere. It just talks randomly about future events where Hal Jordan just seems to travel through the universe, and he makes references to various events that we know nothing about, makes references to a god in red that we know nothing about. And then he ends up, and apparently he's looking for the Green Lantern core that disappeared. And then at the end, he ends up facing Joe Mulane, who is the new Green Lantern of Far Sector. And she's asking him, what happened? Where were you when we needed you? And it was a lot of beautiful art. Beautiful art by Dexter Soy. I could just stare at the pages. That was a consolation due to the fact that there just wasn't much of a story here, but it was beautiful to look at. Finally, the Jeffrey Thorne story, which was called Last Lanterns Part 2. I thought it was interesting. The artist Tom Rainey is really, he's really hit and miss. It was kind of a miss for me, but I didn't really understand. I'm not actually sure if the God in Red actually exists. Was that actually Orion? Is Orion the son of Darkseid? Is Orion supposed to be the God in Red?
That was how the way did that I read come it. Up? Yeah.
Huh?
That was the way right? that I read it. Yeah.
Yeah, I wasn't sure if he was just an illusion or a hologram either. I mean, even the villain, I didn't know. He just popped out of nowhere. And I wondered, why didn't Jon Stewart use... Why didn't they get Orion in the first place to show up and just be and save the day? I didn't understand that. Anyways, maybe you can explain it when you talk about it. But I thought it was difficult to follow. I didn't really understand. I didn't know why we needed this long story to get to the end like we did. I was really disappointed in this story. I got really no interest at all in what Jeffrey Thorne. I mean, he killed Gunort, he killed Salak. I mean, he killed all these classic members of the Green Lantern Corps that I love. I really didn't like it. I didn't. It was a complete miss for me. It did not feel like a Green Lantern comic. It didn't feel like Jon Stewart. It didn't look like Jon Stewart. Was there even the color green in it at any point? I don't know. It was a miss for me. It was a miss. And he tried to do something different and it failed for me. And I'll just leave it at that. I'll say this. I did like the line when Jon Stewart said, "Even out here in the wild, you stink of fear." So Jon Stewart had some pretty cool fanboy moments, I think. But he was Jon Stewart. He wasn't really green. He didn't say it as a Green Lantern. He said it as somebody who wasn't really being a Green Lantern. I don't know. It was a miss for me.
Yeah, well, Jeffrey Thorne is a big Jon Stewart fanboy, so that makes sense that he would fanboy out. And I'll talk about that when I talk about the book, but I'm going to let Trevor give us his thoughts first.
The Jeffrey Thorne, Tom Rady, grainy Green Lantern story, frankly, doesn't deserve the airtime that we're giving it, to be honest with you. This art is so... primitive, I guess would be the way that I would describe it. Honestly, it feels like somebody who grew up on the original 90s Image comics desperately trying to replicate it and even failing to do that. The everything's super scratchy. Where they're placing their blacks is really poor and heavy. Movement feels really static. Camera is boring and planar. It's a poorly done book. Half the time you don't really know what's happening. There's a splash image where there's no panel boundaries, but yet there's two Jon Stewarts on the page somehow with no sort of sign that he was moving from one place to another. There's one in the middle or in the back middle of the page fighting a bunch of what looks to be space orcs and one front and center. And it doesn't make any sense whatsoever. And maybe I could forgive it if it looked good, but it doesn't. So there's that. Story's just kind of convoluted. It's not a Green Lantern story. There's a lot of sort of there's a lack of exposition in favor of Jeffrey Thorne, you know, throwing off a bunch of really unrelated and unintelligible sci-fi dialogue. The Trixalon 5 spazzolator is malfunctioning. I better, I don't know. Like it's bad. That's all that I'm going to give it. It's hard to even go into detail because I would sit here and shit on this story for about an hour. Moving on to the next story, the Teen Lantern. I admittedly have never read a story with this character in it, except for I think the first three issues of Bendis's Young Justice, where I proceeded to drop it because I tend to be the guy that tells people I told you so and get done with it early and wash my hands of it. I will start with something positive, and I agree with Rocky for once here in that I do think that the art has a lot of personality to it. They pick up a decent understanding of camera placement, shot size, but really the design and character acting is pretty solid. I get the impression that this character is youthful, vibrant, and has her own personality. Now, you know, where this does begin to spiral downhill is that she looks about 8 years old. And she's supposed to be Teen Lantern, and wherever this takes place is at least what 2, 3, 4 years after the main continuity. So if she's a teenager in main continuity, she's going to be well into her teenage years to slash towards the end of her teenage years. And she looks about 8 years old here, and she acts about 8 years old here, to be quite honest. The dialogue is overly juvenile. I felt like I was reading a children's story, to be quite frank. There's just this really distasteful and clunky use of external and internal monologuing to give you a sense of her character, to explain things, what have you. Not only is it a total waste of time, but it's a waste of space. You're covering pretty decent art with unnecessary and watered down useless information. The setup was really tropey. You know, the young buck that confidently and ignorantly bites off more than they can chew, only to find out that they're not ready. That was telegraphed from page two. I knew what was coming immediately. It's, you know, it certainly wasn't the worst of what we've seen in Future State. I also don't think it's very good. If there's anything to take away from this, the artist, last name Tong, I don't quite remember the first name.
Andy Tong.
I would definitely like to see more work from them. I would like to see them develop their chops a little bit more, because I think that there was a lot of potential in the artwork here. So, you know, if there's one positive to take out of that story, there's that. And the Robert Venditti, Dexter Soy, Green Lantern story, you know, I don't disagree with Rocky and the art. Dexter Soy is incredible. It feels like you're watching a movie. Now, nothing happens in this story. And I love Robert Venditti. He's one of my favorite writers at DC Comics right now. And I can't help feel like DC was like, hey, we need to fill this other spot. Can you kind of just give us a very vague explanation of where Hal Jordan's been and set up this Jeffrey Thorne guy's run, because he's too inadequate to do it for himself. But you know, what's funny is that this was like the second best story of the week and nothing happened. What does that tell you? What does that tell you? Oh my gosh. Like, at least what's there is pretty well done. Decent dialogue. Feels like Hal Jordan speaking. Visually, the camera is brilliantly done, right? Like, not only is Dexter Soy's design aesthetic this wonderful merger of cinematic and classic house style comic book store sort of aesthetic, but he is a master of shot placement, camera, visually it's a stunner. And you know what's crazy is that, like, you can kind of tell that Dexter is being rushed and he still puts out something great. You know, it's crazy, you know, for all of the sort of breaks throughout these last couple of weeks that we've been doing these, that we've given other artists. And yet you can tell how rushed Dexter Soy was, and he was still able to put out something this decent. And there are handfuls, if not a dozen, other A-list artists who have higher profiles than him that are putting out worse work. That's crazy to me. But yeah, the only thing that was worth the paper it was printed on was the Hal Jordan story by Venditti and Soy. And even then, admittedly, pretty much nothing happened. You know, it's all plot and no plot. And by that, I mean, you're getting a singular plot point stretched out over one whole story. And yeah, it's pretty well done, but nothing happens. And, you know, frankly, I couldn't in good conscience recommend anybody waste their money on this book.
Yep, I agree 100%. I agree with you about Venditti. If DC probably went to him, hey, you haven't written, you know, Green Lantern, you know, we know he's one of your favorite characters, can you fill these pages for us? It's completely unclear where so at the end of the Hal Jordan Green Lantern story continued in Green Lantern in 2021 in March, which is obviously going to be the Jeffrey Thorne. So is this not happening in the way in the future? Kind of like to your point of the Teen Lantern story. Is that kind of happening right now, maybe just a few months in the future, rather than, I mean, it is Future State and we know it's a sliding timeline. So it seems like those are almost in current continuity. But the worst part about the Robert Venditti, Hal Jordan story, because again, like you guys said, the Dexter Soy art is incredible. And Robert Venditti, he paces well, his dialogue, is always sharp and contextual and relevant. You know, he doesn't fall into those too many word kind of things. But the bad part about it was it just reinforced what I already thought, despite Jeffrey Thorne spewing hate about Hal Jordan online and saying, oh, no, that's just my fan opinion. And I'm a professional writer. And when it comes to actually writing the story, I'm not going to shit on Hal Jordan. Well, this tells me that you are, because, you know, right away we have Joe Mullen blaming everything on Hal. So even if, oh, it's just the typical misunderstanding of comics, he wouldn't have ever flipped it and put John Stewart in that position. And you want proof of that? Just read the first story. Mm. And I'll get to that in a second. So that, to me, that's what was disappointing. You know, I was excited. Oh, Robert Venditti back on Green Lantern. You know, he had such a tough time because he followed Geoff Johns, who, you know, beloved, and it was such an epic run. Maybe the best work of John's career, you know, creating the different, you know, Lantern cores for all the different colors and Blackest Night and all that stuff. I mean, rightly it's praised, and Venditti had to follow that. That's a tough act to follow. And I think he did an incredible job and doesn't get enough credit for that. So to have him back on Hal, I was excited. And then we got that non-story where at the end, Joe Mullen's kind of crapping on Hal. And I'm just, and that didn't sit right for me because, again, continued in 2021. And that's Jeffrey Thorne's story. As far as the second story, I just think that Teen Lantern's a waste of a character. She doesn't need to exist. Clearly, Bendis ripping off himself for Riri Williams. And she's not even a good imitation of Riri Williams because she's not special. She didn't. It's not even like she went out and found the gauntlet. The alien just gave it to her. You know, you go read Young Justice 9. He just gives it to her because she happens to be there. And, oh, I'm going to go to Metropolis and I'm going to be a hero. Well, how are you going to do that? Well, this thing, it's a powerful thing. It's a weapon or something. It's not a Green Lantern ring. And she's talking to her buddy, Marco or Marcos or whatever. And he's like, well, just concentrate. And then all of a sudden it snaps into place. She figures out how to use it. She can fly, whatever. It doesn't look like the Chrono Power Gauntlet, at least not when she first gets it. I guess that could be sort of interesting. This, you know, really powerful gauntlet, the power gauntlet that Chrono created in the hands of, you know, a girl who's super irresponsible and young and inexperienced or whatever. But we haven't gotten any of that from the character. And so in my mind, throw on the trash heap. I don't care. I couldn't possibly care less about this character. Like, I just could not care less. But the art is great. I agree with you guys there. And I also want to call out the colors. I think the colors are done very well in both of the last two stories. They're spectacular. Unfortunately, mm-hmm. the first story, the only thing that is done well is the colors and maybe the lettering. John Stewart, did you guys know he was descended from pygmies? Because that's sort of what he looks like. There's so many panels here where the guy just looks like he's about 4 foot tall. And I don't understand it. The art is wildly inconsistent. The anatomy sometimes is so bad, you can't help but be pulled out of the story. I especially have a problem with the way he does his faces. You know, sometimes somebody will have a giant forehead in one panel, and then on the very next page, they hardly have any forehead at all. Like, there's just no consistency at all. I don't understand. I mean, look at this face here. That's horrible. This is the same person?
No forehead.
It's just, it makes no sense. The art is just awful. And there's no other way to put it. As far as the story itself, again, this is all about Jeffrey Thorne being a John Stewart fanboy. I'll never spend my money on anything Jeffrey Thorne writes because he has shown me, first of all, he doesn't have any professionalism. I don't care who you are. You don't just spew out hate for a character and then get put on that book, I guess, unless you want to write for DC. Apparently that works. To me, that's not professional. Whether it's your own opinion or not, you keep that to yourself. You don't spew it out there in public and say, hey, I want to write Green Lantern. I'm a huge John Stewart fan, but Hal Jordan is the worst comic character ever created. No, to me, I don't care. You know, I already had my reservations and I picked this up anyway, hoping he'd prove me wrong because he said, oh, I can separate. I didn't think he could, and he's proved it here. Can someone explain to me how these Kuhns, who are one of the most military and warlike races in the entire pantheon of DC, and they outnumber John Stewart, you know, 100, 200 to 1. He has no Green Lantern powers whatsoever. It would be hard enough for him to win the battle that way. He has no powers whatsoever. They throw him an axe, and he just, oh, because Marine? He can just defeat all these aliens that are raised from birth. It makes no sense. in any way, shape, or form? And can you also tell me how, you know, he's speaking to the leader of the Coons, and he's like, you know, fight or flee, we're going to give you a chance. He releases him from the stasis field that he's being held in. He throws him the axe. John Stewart gets to go on the run and beats up all these Coons. And then the next time we see John Stewart after he finishes the battle, where he talks about, oh, you know, you can beat the Coons because I know your weak spots. You have so many arteries, I can just cut you anywhere and you bleed out. And then the next time we see John Stewart, he's in the stasis field again. What happened? He was winning. He was beating. All he has to do is cut them and they just die. And then all of a sudden he's in the stasis field again. The next time we see him on screen a couple pages later, it makes zero sense. And you know, it just made me sick to my stomach. It really did. This is like the worst kind of fanboy, fan fiction, pandering kind of story that I've ever seen. It's just awful. That the scene at the end with Stewart holding the sword of Orion above his head, and just, this is what Jeffrey Thorne's Green Lantern is going to be. John Stewart's the greatest character ever. Oh, I love John Stewart. You know what? I don't really have anything against John Stewart as a character. I think that he's been inconsistent over the years, and we've talked about it in the past, how I still see him as that architect background. Others see him with the Marine background. In my mind, nobody's done a definitive John Stewart run yet. Maybe Thorne feels the same way, and that's what he's going to do. But I don't have any confidence that he can come at it without just fanboy gushing. And so,
you know what the worst part about it is? As long as he goes out into the press and continues to say that I am writing a definitive John Stewart run, the fans will believe it. The fans will believe it, because the minute Josh Williamson started talking about how he has the longest Flash run ever, all of the Flash fans and their mothers were like, this is one of the greatest Flash runs of all time. I'm sorry, man. Like, it doesn't matter how much you say or what you say about something. It matters what you do with it. And I don't care how long you're on the character, how short you're on the character. None of it matters if it's not good.
Yeah, this is not good. That's the bottom line. It's not good. You can't just, because you like John Stewart, make him the badass of the universe. He has no powers, and he's defeating these Coons left and right with just an axe. He has no power. I don't care if you're a trained Marine. These Coons, their strength vastly outranks the strength level of a normal human. It just doesn't make any sense. It was just an awful story. I'll get off my soapbox. I'll be a lot shorter on the rest of these books. But, man, I got a call. I was going to say a spade. I probably should say that about Jeffrey Thorne. But I got to call out bad writing if it's bad writing. And this is bad. This is bad fan fiction is what this is. All right, well, let's move on to the next book. Since we're on a roll with books that aren't very good.
Well, I mean, that's literally almost all of them. So whatever you say next could be anything.
All right, I was thinking Teen Titans number 2. I will let you go first, Trevor. We'll let you, what did you say earlier? Fall on the sword?
Yeah. Before I do say that, one thing I forgot to mention about the Robin thing, there's an editor's note about how signing translations aren't grammatical in the grammatical tense of ASL. It's so funny that that's what DC editorial is focusing on over a decent story that makes any sense or, you know, quality of the craft. But, you know, it's important to make sure that we don't offend anybody who knows American Sign Language.
Yeah.
That great priorities, DC Comics. It's very clear where you're coming from. So yeah, Teen Titans number 2 might have been worse than the first one. I'm going to try to keep these brief. Otherwise, I could shit all over them for hours, as evident by some of these past episodes that we've done. I think Jace kind of took over for me on that last one. Thank God, because I'm getting tired of being the guy to do that. The dialogue is horrible, right? So first of all, from the first issue, we've consistently had a problem knowing what's going on, what the context is, how these things are happening. And Tim Sheridan is just dressing the issue in dialogue in order to try to tell you what's happened. But it shifts very suddenly. He uses like this interruption method between characters, whether they're just kind of talking about something that is isolated or they're talking about what's going on at large. But it proves to be really annoying more than anything else, and startling, to the point where anytime we begin to think that we might get any remote sense of what's going on, somebody gets interrupted. And you can rely on that more than you can rely on actually getting the information and the exposition that a decent writer would know to provide. Sheridan is very much playing with a writer's toolbox that he has no idea how to use. It feels like an infant with a tool shed, to be quite frank. As the scenes grow, the flow of information through dialogue becomes even more messy and confusing. At some point, you have like a dozen characters on screen. All of them need to talk and interrupt each other. And it just gets just as jumbled. And unfortunately, Rafa Sandoval does not make that any easier. Visually, it's really hard to tell what's going on half of the time, especially once you get onto the quote unquote battlefield of the issue. You know, and I say that as an avid Rafa Sandoval fan, another one of those artists that I think is incredibly underrated in the industry. We're consistently being told what's happened without any semblance of how any of it's happened. And that is also well represented in the art, unfortunately. It just doesn't, none of this makes any sense. And we're not given any sense of it at all, which sucks, because I'm pretty open to reading a story, not having it make sense, and have a talented writer come in there knowing how to engage plot and narrative to fill in the blocks in an entertaining and satisfying way. None of that has happened here. And as a somebody who admittedly knows almost nothing about the H dial and dial H for hero, I'm a little bit reluctant to believe that a bunch of half-baked child superheroes that are at an academy to learn how to do what they do have modified this incredibly powerful and undoubtedly complex device into doing something that I'm not sure it's ever done before. What also doesn't make any sense by the end of the story is they're fighting the seven deadly sins, including the evil Wally West from the horrible Future State Flash story that everybody loves. What doesn't really make a lot of sense is that it seems like the seven deadly sins can manipulate people and pretty much mind control them for all intents and purposes. Why didn't they do that from the beginning? Why couldn't they have done that before the cavalry arrived and surprised them with their own teammate and murked them all? Why did they wait to start picking them off one by one and not just control the lot of them? It doesn't make any sense. And just unfortunately, visually, Rafa Sandoval just has so much going on, and you know, his design quality isn't what we're used to, which, you know, we sort of come to expect with Future State. But I don't know if it's because of the way it's scripted or simply because Sandoval is trying to make sense of all of these asks that are being made by Sheridan, but this literally makes no sense. There's a part in the story when you think everything is all good and done, and that the seven deadly sins have been tethered and rendered nullified, and all of a sudden everybody gets controlled by them, and you literally don't know what's happening the whole time. And what's crazy is that if I hadn't read this Future State story, I would have picked up Titans Academy issue one. Now that I have read this Future State story, I've messaged my retailer and said, I'm sorry to cancel this on you. I will buy three books in its place. I will not support this book. I'm sorry.
Rocky, what are your thoughts?
Wow. I share the sentiment of Trevor. I'm going to be a little bit more positive. I do think that I actually, somewhere in this mess of a narrative lies some interesting tidbits of a plot. From what I could gather, and Trevor, you could be right and I could be wrong, so I'm not going to die on this hill. I think it wasn't the seven deadly sins. I thought it was war, pestilence, death, and famine, which I thought was the four horsemen of apocalypse and their spirit. Yeah. But yeah, maybe I'm wrong on that, so I'm not going to...
I think you're right. I 100% think you're right.
Okay. Well, it's neither here nor there. It's the fact that you even thought that, or I questioned myself, kind of tells you just how convoluted this narrative was, because nothing really stood out. And I'm going to take this from a different tact. You know, I want to be excited about Titans Academy. When I think of Titans Academy, I think of the potential of an umbrella academy. I'm thinking about the potential of a deadly class, Rick Remender, that independent series by Image. I'm thinking of the potential of a Strange Academy. I want to get excited about a new number of potentially new heroes in the DC universe. And what do I get teased with when I read Future State? I don't get any character development. I get no introduction to new characters about why I should like them. Instead, I get ridiculous names like Totally Tubular, Brat Girl, Chupacabra, and Gorilla Greg. And they look ridiculous. And I'm thinking to myself, why should I like these characters? Not only that, they actually, in my view, criminally assault Miguel. They steal his H style. They hack into it and attempt to raise the dead, and they attempt to raise Roy Harper from the dead in that one scene, if I read that correctly.
Yes.
They're trying to raise Roy Harper from the dead. Now, I guess, fair enough. I guess if they're doing this, this is potentially, if this was organically played out, this could be an interesting 4 or 5 issue story arc in the main Titans Academy comic book. But clearly they're bullies. They're borderline criminal. And by the way, Roy Harper, I think, is Red X. There's a theory going around online, and I think it's accurate. I do think when they at some point they type in Titans on the H dial, and all the previously dead Titans come back. But the only one who doesn't come back, if you notice, is Roy Harper. And I think that's because Roy Harper's already alive, and I think Roy Harper is Red X. And that's not my theory. That's somebody else's. But I'm just sharing it. I think that's likely. But in any event, part of me is a little bit curious about who Red X is. I bought the spec book with him on the cover, so I'm a little bit curious. But I just don't like. I would have liked to have seen this played out more. I would have liked to have seen this had 4 issues of development in Future State, because this is leading into Titans Academy trying to attract new readership. This should be. Just like the Batman Dark Detective, this should also be 4 issues long, not crammed into 2, because I think that there was a story here that could have played out better. Unfortunately, it feels very rushed. It seems to me that just to play out my understanding of the plot was that war, pestilence, death, and famine embody Wally West, embody Roundhouse, and a couple others, and somehow they utilize the dead Titans. They call the dead Titans back to life with the H dial. They attack war, pestilence, death, and famine, weaken them. Raven then sucks them into her body, her spirit, and Shazam takes her into the Rock of Eternity, where he's going to sacrifice himself and never change back into Billy, and keep all those wars, all those 4 horsemen of apocalypse trapped at the Rock of Eternity. That's what I understand the plot to be, but apparently it's not ending. This is continuing in the pages of Shazam #2, Future State. So again, I had to reread this thing 3 or 4 times in order to piece that together. And maybe that's just me. Maybe I should, you know,
No, it's not you.
Yeah.
It's not you, Rock. It's honestly not you. Like, it's like, I mean, the worst part is, like, I'm the one that's usually known for, like, picking stuff out or like really, even if it's vague, picking up on what the writer and artist are putting down. And I literally sat there having no idea what the fuck was going on. like when they were getting dragged into the Rock of Eternity, if she tethered the 4 horsemen, how did Dickstroke and the rest of the Titans get controlled?
That's Deathwing to you.
It's Deathwing to me. Ah, oh, dude. Like, and what's crazy is, Rock, what kills me is that I grew up on the Titans cartoon with Red X. I was dumb excited when I saw Red X on the cover of a comic book. You know who doesn't care about the comic book that Red X is on now? Me. I grew up with that stuff. That Teen Titans show is what helped get me into comics. Yeah. And now look at this. This guy's so bad that I don't care.
Well, and that leads into the very final page, of course, that says, if you know, with Shazam walking into the power, into the Rock of Eternity, holding Raven. And then, of course, you have that, you know, you have the words, want to know how we got to this point? Tune in, come back in March. It's like, are you kidding me? I'm going to come back in March and stick around for 12 months.
Yeah,
that's not going to happen.
Sheridan doesn't even have a handle on the old characters. How do I think he's going to be able to create new ones and have them be relatable or consistent to any degree?
And I just want to say one more comment here before Jace, before you talk. And that is that I don't know, but I can't imagine Dick Grayson ever assuming a mantle with the name Death in it. Deathwing. I can't imagine. That is so out of Dick Grayson's character. I don't care how much you degrade his character. I don't see him ever, ever dressing up, assuming anything in terms of his wardrobe or symbolically or thematically ever assuming any kind of mantle that would be akin to Deathstroke, Slade Wilson in any way, shape or form. That is such a degradation of the character and an insult to the character and a fundamental misunderstanding of the character. I just can't, that just blows me away. Anybody who's familiar with the history of the Teen Titans, heck, the Judas contract was the formative years. That was the adventure that converted him into Nightwing. For him to assume the mantle and to in a halfway measure of Deathstroke is an insult to the character and shitting all over the franchise. And of course, you know, you can accuse me of overreacting, but I'm a classic George Perez, Marv Wolfman fan, and this is a giant flipping the bird to everything that Dick Grayson stands for and Nightwing, in my opinion.
Where's the retweet button? God damn, I'd retweet the shit out of that.
Well, I really couldn't disagree with you guys more. I think this is the single best issue of the entire Future State event. This is so good. What, did you guys not read the same comic as me? Okay, not really. I just can't even say that with a straight face. Oh my God, this was crap. 100% crap. You don't need to buy this comic. You really want to know, you love the Titans, you got to be a completist. Okay, here's what you do. Walk into your comic shop, read the first page where I agree with you, Rocky, about the whole any sort of name Dick Grayson using having Death in it. The only thing that maybe I could say is that he doesn't actually call himself that. Starfire does. So yeah, what, do you know what you're wearing? Deathwing, like question mark, yeah. Like she's, you know, and Changeling, or I guess, what's his name?
Cybeast.
There you go. Half cyborg, half beast. Like, I would have gone with Dijkstra. Like, just put it out there. Dijkstroke. We all know he's Dijkstroke. That's what his name would be. So I did appreciate that they actually acknowledged that and threw that in there. So that was great. Far and away, the best moment, the only good moment in these the entire two issues of this Teen Titans series. So read that page. Read the first page. Have that moment. And then just skip to the last page, like Rocky said. Yeah. Where it says, you know, if you want to know what's going on or how we got here, then go read Teen Titans Academy coming in March 2021. As far as the middle pages, even if you read them, you won't know what the fuck is going on. So don't waste your time. Go in, pick the book up off the rack, read that moment about Dijkstroke, and then go and look at the last page and it'll tell you, hey, read Teen Titans Academy in March 2021 if that's your choice. And there you go. You just saved yourself $4. You know, I'm not trying to take the money out of any retailer's pocket, but I'm just trying to save you the pain and save you the time of reading this complete garbage, because you don't know what's going on. Like, yeah, you get the basic. If you have a deep understanding of the Titans and you know about Roy Harper's history of being dead, not being dead, them all being a close-knit kind of thing, whatever. You've read all the rest of the Future State stuff, including the Terrible Flash series, and you know about Wally being famine and that sort of thing, then yeah, you can kind of pull out little things and get to that point where, you know, Rocky kind of explained the plot, but he had to read it 3 or 4 times to get there. I didn't bother reading it 3 or 4 times. Now that he explains it, I'm able to see, okay, yeah, some of the stuff I got, some I didn't. Like, yeah, they were trying to bring Roy Harper back. Yeah, Roy Harper's probably Red X, but you know what? I don't fucking care. This is a shitty comic, and you don't waste your time. That's just the bottom line. I'm not a big Titans guy, so I wasn't planning on picking it up Teen Titans Academy anyway. And this just tells me I'm not going to miss anything. because, oh my God, is this just bad? And that's all. That's all I got to say about that.
I genuinely thought that the joke you were going to make was the best part of this book was when you turn the last page and realize it's over.
Well, yeah. As I told you, when you still needed to read the books so we could come on and talk about this, and I'd already read them all, I was like, you know, I'm so glad I read that. Like, glad, not glad I read them. Glad I've already read them so I don't have to read them and experience the pain of reading them again. But not glad I read them in the first place because it was such a waste of time and money.
Yep.
Anyway, let's move on. Well, we're on such a roll, I guess we'll keep with at least what I consider to be the lower rung of bad here. Kara Zor-El, Superwoman number 2 from the Marguerites. So it's written by Marguerite Bennett. We have art by Marguerite Sauvage. The letters are by Wes Abbott. And I don't know. I'm such a Marguerite Bennett fan. And this just, I got done reading this and I felt like I didn't understand what the point was of this book. Supergirl ends up dead at the end, or Superwoman, excuse me. And is that supposed to make us feel something? Because if it is, it didn't work for me. I didn't feel anything. In the end, the book ends up covering just a huge amount of time. And I guess we're supposed to feel the legacy and the impact that Kara had by creating this colony on the moon. But in the end, it felt like just masturbatory. Like I don't know why this book needs to exist. I really don't. Any of the emotion or the impact we're supposed to feel about, you know, Supergirl having, you know, become a pacifist and wanting to just focus on her compassion and empathy, which certainly is, you know, a valid part of the character and one of the things I love most about her. But the fact that she has that empathy and that compassion and chooses to go out and physically put herself in harm's way, to me, that's what's special about her. Go back and read the Mark and Draco story, especially the issues with Teen Titans and Supergirl, or not Teen Titans, I'm sorry, the Omega Men. You know, that's the stuff that was good. This just didn't work for me. The only thing I'll say about the art is that it just doesn't speak to me. We talked about it last time. I think Marguerite Sauvage's art just doesn't work on superhero books for me personally. It's not that the art is bad, but it doesn't convey, you know, movement and the kind of dynamic sense I feel that you need when you're having superheroes battle giant, I don't know, space dragons, I guess they are. So yeah, it just, this book didn't work for me on any level. And honestly, it was a chore to get through. So what did you think, Rocky?
Well, you know, it's funny because I took notes on every book I read, and this is the one comic that I read that I took no notes on at all. And that's not because it was the worst, because it wasn't. At least it had an ending. This actually feels like something that would be in DC Superhero Girls or something. It does feel, it definitely feels something that Marguerite Bennett would write. It's not a bad story, but it's a very generic story with a very sort of like by the numbers moral and theme about, you know, be nice, you know, choose the higher ground, you know, don't choose anger, you know, don't choose anger, choose love and acceptance. And it should be noted that the story is actually called Two Graves. And I think that's a reference to that old expression, when you embark in anything with revenge as your goal, then dig two graves, obviously one for your enemy and one for yourself, because anything that's premised on revenge is going to lead to destruction. And ultimately the lesson here is this Lanari character utilizing Supergirl's powers ultimately through the story ends up eliminating a power source or a power source that was inherited on her planet from generation to generation, which everybody fought for. And it ended up everyone, by eliminating this power source, ultimately everyone became normal again. And then ultimately everyone was, it seemed to be, at the end, they were deprived of their powers, but they could all live on the moon as happily ever after. And everybody was singing, holding hands at one point. And I think the only thing I never saw was a can of Coca-Cola, you know, singing hands and singing Kumbaya and everyone's, you know, love and grace. And at the end, Supergirl is dead and she's buried alongside Crypto. I mean, and apparently we who, if we're wondering how we get here, apparently at some point, Kara has a very, very deep bonding experience with Crypto, the super dog, because she's more closer to Crypto than she is to any other member of the Superman family. This is, I'm making fun of it a little bit. This is schoolyard, schoolgirl kind of storytelling, which I don't want to put down because I think there's a market for that. But this is not it. This should not have been a story that was told in Future State. This was not the appropriate form by which to tell this story. This, I could see this being in a graphic novelization for maybe, sold alongside Dog Man or something like that. And maybe try to get a younger demographic from, let's say, you know, 10 to 12 year olds and, you know, sell for, you know, $10 on a, you know, in a graphic novelization form for, you know, preteens. But this was just you could totally skip this. It has nothing to do with future. It really doesn't really, it's not helpful at all. It's nonsense. She's on the moon of all places. What the hell does Supergirl stand for? At the end, she doesn't even have a legacy. She doesn't even have a husband. She doesn't even have children. It even brags about the fact that Superwoman's legacy isn't the fact that she's got offspring, but it's what she stands for, you know? Basically, it was exceptionally disappointing. And if you're a Superwoman fan or a Supergirl fan, I don't know how you can read this and not be extremely disappointed with the lack, with the ultimate failure of Superwoman just dying lonely by herself as an old lady on the moon. How is that uplifting? You know, again, throughout this whole Future State thing, I hate to sound like a broken record because I want to bitch slap myself every time I say it, but where's the hope? Where's the hope? How many years do we got to say that? We keep saying the same thing to DC and they keep going out of their way to say, no, it's been 2 years of misery. We gave you Death Metal. No hope, no more hope. No, we're not going to go that. We're not going to give you a rebirth again. No, just misery and death and destruction, misery and death and destruction. And just to make sure that that never ends, we're going to make Joshua Williamson the head of everything when we go into New Frontier. Yeah. So don't worry about that. Yeah. Forget about hope. It's never going to happen. Yeah. Anyways, I'm done. Rant finished.
The hope is that we all hope it gets better, but I don't have any hope left to give. What did you think about this one, Trevor?
I thought a good portion of what Rock said actually really summed up my thoughts as well. It felt like a children's book, from the visual aesthetic to the storytelling. Just very sort of juvenile, super cookie cutter, and frankly out of character for Kara Zor-El. But I guess you can do that in kids' books, as they have been with like super Gotham High Bruce Wayne and him having a love triangle with the Joker in high school. So that's pretty much what this felt like. I guess for the art, it's a little bit less of a dig because there is a huge market for, you know, children's comic book art. Writing probably a little bit more so, unfortunately, just because like this, I mean, Marguerite Bennett's written in comics for years. Like she's a veteran comic book writer now. She's written some good stuff. And, you know, to get something like this in the main line of DC Comics, which is for, you know, young adults and adults, you really missed your audience here. You know, I was just bored to bits, to be honest with you. It's like a lot of these other books, like I guess it kind of hooked me by how bad they were, where I could like just sink my teeth into, you know, horrible craft. But honestly, this one was just so boring that I didn't have the energy to do that. I mean, I guess frankly I've had less the energy to put in the time to give specific critiques on a craft level to these books because they're just so bad. And, you know, a guy only has so much energy, but I was born to bits. I'm sure that this probably would have served a better purpose if it was in the Scholastic Book Fair for children.
Yep. Agree. All right. Well, let's move on to, I guess we'll talk about Superman, Wonder Woman, issue 2. I know you sound so excited. Talk about this book, Trevor. Let me give the credit to you. We'll let Rocky go first and let you save up some energy so you can talk about it. Dan Waters does the script, Lila Del Duca on art, Nick Filardi on colors, Tom Napolitano on letters. What are your thoughts on this one, Rocky?
Ah, good Lord.
good Lord.
You know, this was, the artistic, I'm just, you know, let's start off with a 2-page spread. This has got to be my vote for the worst drawn 2-page spread that probably in over a decade that I've ever seen. There's a picture here of Superman. He never looks like a man throughout the entire series, as far as I'm concerned, but it's Superman punching the sun, and it's the most god awful image. It looks ridiculous. For some reason, the artist decided to draw Superman punching the sun with Superman looking like he's horizontal. It almost looks like, if I didn't know better, he's a bad guy trying to rape something. And it looks awful. It almost looks like he's looking like he, and he's punching the sun. It takes up 2 pages. And the whole point of it, like narratively, the purpose of that page was to show that Superman punching out the actual sun would knock out the god representing the sun. That was the point of that. And after he hit the sun, the god, in fact, got knocked unconscious. But just think of that from an artistic standpoint. Like, I'm not an artist. I don't draw shit. I'm terrible. I can't even draw stick man. Okay. But I'm just thinking to myself, you got 2 pages to try to convey that. Like, if you're trying to convey that when you hit the sun, it has an impact on the god who represents the sun, isn't there a better way? You had 2 full pages to convey that than drawing that god awful, like that. Oh my God. It was just artistically, the art's so bad in this. It was just so bad. I will leave it to Trevor to use the he's better at language at describing art than I am. So I'll leave it to him to articulate that. But suffice to say, I thought this was just a disappointment. I thought there was some nice dialogue, some nice moments between Yara Flor and John Kent. I think I like the fact that John Kent, they alluded to some of his responsibilities in caring for other planets, and they had to shoot that gun into the black hole every day at 10:30 a.m. because it's alluding to the fact that he's got other responsibilities outside of Earth. And it reminded me a little bit of the Silver Age, where Superman had these awesome responsibilities at this Fortress of Solitude that went beyond just himself. So there were some allusions there. And yes, I'm digging here, trying to find something nice to say, but I'm trying to be nice here. It had its moments. I do like Yara Flor's attitude. I love her personality. I thought that came through. Yara Flor continues to be, in fact, Yara Flor is the most consistently better written character of Future State than any of them. I would say she's probably the best consistently throughout all the different writers. And by that, that's important, because when you can get all the various different writers, ranging from the good writers to the really bad writers, but at least consistently getting one character right, that says a lot about a character. And I think that that's one of the reasons why I think Yara Flor has got some promise moving forward. And so I'm looking at that as a positive. But really, as a story, this was a really, really, this is a big miss for me. And I'm just glad it's done.
Trevor?
Yes, Jace, I'll take "This Story Sucks" for 500, please.
Rocky totally had it. I mean, this art is bad. I get the sense that the artist is trying to do some mixed media stuff. I'll refer you to Liam Sharp. Go look at how a master does mixed media comic book art, because you can't even do standard comic book art. So, you know, go do some studying up. The story was convoluted, frankly, kind of dumb. Story felt like it belonged in a children's book, just like the last one did. And I'm not in love with the way John is kind of characterized as a doof. You know, he, at this point, he's been Superman for longer than Clark has been Superman in the main continuity. He wouldn't be a doof. In fact, he had Clark, and for all intents and purposes, Bruce as like a godfather to help teach him what to do and to sort of field the questions that nobody could field for Bruce or Clark. John should be a fucking stud. And that's one of the things that I hate most about Future State, is that he gets kind of pinned off as a doofus. You know, Yara Flor was fine. Certainly not as good as the characterization of Yara Flor in the actual Yara Flor Wonder Woman book. And, you know, you guys know by now, you know, I love me a thick Wonder Woman, but, you know, I just wish it were a better drawn thick Wonder Woman. From an artistic standpoint, there's a lot that I don't like about this. The artist has no idea where to place the camera at all. It's usually very planar, doesn't really know how to take advantage of perspective, shot size, you name it. I mean, that full page, excuse me, was that a double page splash of Superman punching the sun was the dullest thing I've seen in a long time. And even the lettering in this grand, big air quotes, I know you guys can't see my fingers, grand image, there's a little pow on the page, literally the size of an inch, little pow. Not even the lettering could try to rectify this, because this shot is a field of yellows and reds and oranges with Superman in a lame ass pose in front of it. It doesn't look like he's moving. It doesn't look like he's striking. It's super planar and he's centered in the middle of the shot and it's flat. We're doing this really sort of cookie cutter. It's not even a wide shot. It like maybe full at best. And it just looks dull, and Superman's supposed to be punching the fucking sun. This should be a cool visual moment. You take it from I'm not an artist, and I can tell you a million ways to fix this image. Take the camera, put it behind him as he strikes the sun. Show flames fanning out from the force of his fucking punch. Show him moving. Jesus Christ, if you took a Rob Liefeld pose, this would be more compelling. But it looks so flat. It's so boring. And then the next one, just narratively, there's another full page splash of the god falling out of the sun. And then the next second we know he's on Earth. Where are the visual story beats here? None of that adds up. What'd you do? Punch him and he teleports down to Earth? Is this golden Silver Age Superman, excuse me, where he can do whatever the fuck you want and we're just not going to talk about it? I just, like, in terms of physical blocking, there are so many things that don't add up, right? One second something's happening here, and then the next panel in sequence visually doesn't make any sense in terms of position, blocking, what's going on with the characters. Excuse me. It's a poorly done comic book, man. Was it DeLuca on art, man? I usually love me my unfound Italian artists, but you know, you can, if you want to, you can keep them unfound, because this guy needs some serious work. And clearly, I don't even know who wrote this, to be honest with you. Dan Waters. Wow, that's disappointing, because Dan Waters isn't a bad writer. It's just so poorly done, and you can tell in numerous scenarios. I don't know if it was because of the script. I assume it was because of the script, but it could be because of the art, that they're stretching out moments in terms of panel size that aren't really warranted, right? Like the size and the shape of the panel and how much space it's taking up is going to be a big factor in pacing. It's going to be a big factor in tone. It's going to be a big factor in tension, drama, what have you. And there are so many moments, like, for example, the god fall, like, kind of looking like he's innocuously floating throughout space. Like, you can tell that they were desperate to fill up this page space and that this story didn't belong in two issues. I mean, I don't think it belongs anywhere, because frankly, I think it's pretty bad, but it certainly didn't belong over the course of two issues. There's not enough substance here. And there's, you know, I will say there was one good shot in this book. One good shot. It's a low angle of Yara Flor firing whatever that inorganic god gun thing up into the sky. That was a good shot, right? Like, I don't know if anybody's looking at it. It's a nice low angle. It's a decent use of speed lines that are focalized around whatever she's firing. There's this sort of energy that is that draws the eye up into whatever sort of hole this gun is creating. There's a sense of energy, movement, stature. That's where you put the camera. That's the one spot in this book where this artist has shown that they have a vague understanding of what to do with the camera during this type of scene. But other than that, it's surprising because honestly, that one particular panel that takes up 2/3 of the page looks like Joelle Jones drew it. It really does in terms of the caliber and the understanding of composition. And in the quality of the design, and then everything else, well, except for the fact that her butt is flat for some reason. Yara Flor is supposed to be thick, but like, otherwise there's no substance here at all.
I thought there was two good. I mean, I did notice that panel. I didn't think it was terrible. I actually think the best panel in the book is two pages later, and it's just a small panel, and it's close up on Yara Flor where she still has the gun on her shoulder.
That was okay. I felt that you could very much see, like, she didn't look like she was being pushed back by the force of whatever that gun was emitting to me. It very much felt like the artist drew her in a very sort of rigid lunging position, and that they added the speed lines and that black sort of spiral energy.
No, not that one. Go down.
Go down.
Below, and the one on the right. Where it's just her face. That to me is the best panel in the whole book, because it's the only panel in the whole book where the anatomy looks correct to me in terms of proportions.
Yeah, I mean, it's
a good picture of this. To me, shows me the artist can draw, but where is any of this correct anatomy or rendering anywhere else in the whole book? It doesn't exist.
And that's the thing though, in that comics, is that you don't have to get the anatomy right, but you have to convince the reader's eye that it makes sense.
Yep. So, I mean, I agree with a lot of what you guys said. This kind of, it's just a failure. It's wildly inconsistent art. Superman punching the sun. Talk about a tweet. Dark Knight praises Rob Liefeld. Liefeld, use a Liefeld pose. Anything would have been better than this pose.
Dude.
It just doesn't make any sense at all. As far as positives, so there are some concepts in here that I like. I like the fact that we're diving into some other mythology other than just, you know, European mythology or you know, Western culture mythology, white mythology, for a lack of a better term. At least we're talking about some Brazilian gods. Yara Flor, obviously Brazilian. So the fact that there's a little more diversity in mythology, I like that. I like that they're pulling that in. I like some of the moments with John and Yara, because that is a legacy relationship, you know, Clark and Diana, and you know, now trying to carry that on. I do agree that John's characterization isn't very good. And those moments, I like the concept of them. They're not necessarily executed that well. I like the concept of using, you know, South American mythology, Brazilian mythology, but just because you have an idea doesn't mean that it's executed well. And here it's not executed very well. So that's the best thing I can say, is interesting ideas, but ultimately it wasn't executed very well. I don't even think the color work in this book is done particularly well. So in my mind, yeah, just not a good comic. And the worst part about it is the wild inconsistency of the art. It is just bad. There's no other way to put it. So let's move on to Justice League number two. There's two stories. The first one is written by Joshua Williamson. Sorry, I'm trying to remember who did the art or find the credit.
Robson Rocha.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, Robson Rocha on art. And then the colors were by Robson Rocha did the pencils, inks by Daniel Ricas, colors by Romulo Fajardo Jr., and letters by Tom Napolitano. And then there's a backup story, Justice League Dark by Ram V. Art is by Marcio Takara, colors by Marcelo Maiello, letters by Rob Lee. I'm going to talk about the backup first. Didn't care for the art. And even the colors, Marcelo Maiello is a colorist whose work I generally enjoy. I've given him my colorist of the year before. But I guess he's trying to use a subdued palette to kind of convey this dystopian future, but it just, the colors felt kind of blah to me. And even though I'm a huge fan of Ram V, I don't know, maybe he just didn't have an out, because it didn't feel like it had kind of the excitement of most of the Justice League Dark story and issues that he's done so far. This just felt kind of paint by the numbers, and I won't say lazy writing, but again, not an ending, with Dr. Fate sort of sacrificing himself, but then whispering to Etrigan the demon, on his way to his heroic sacrifice, you don't perceive time the way we do. Your past actions can still influence and change the future you've seen. Oh, okay, I guess. It's always, we've talked about this before, it's always a slippery slope when you start talking about time travel and time jumps and, how to make these stories matter. And maybe, we're being too hard on Future State overall. We here on one hand, we're saying, why should anybody care about these? There are only two issues. And now DC is saying, okay, this stuff's not ending. And now we're saying, well, why couldn't we have gotten an ending? But the thing is, it's like, if these were just going to be two issues, have a clean ending because they're not very good. If they were good, then we'd be saying, yeah, we're happy that they're still continuing and we're not necessarily getting, clean endings and we're having to go back and read Teen Titans Academy, or we can still explore the Gotham in Gotham City in this era of Future State by going and reading Future State Gotham. But the fact of the matter is, the stuff is so bad that we don't want it to continue. So this is just another example of that. And on top of it, like I've already complained about multiple times on the podcast, if I want to go and read any of Ram V's Justice League Dark, I got to buy Brian Michael Bendis's Justice League.
Yep.
I'm noping right out of that. Hell no, DC.
Yep.
You got me to waste money on Future State. I'm not wasting a penny more on anything Brian Michael Bendis does. So if I hear really good things about Justice League Dark, well, I do have an advantage that most don't, in that I'll read my press preview copies and just read the Ram V stuff, or maybe they'll collect it, the Ram V stuff, so I can have it for my shelf and kind of continue my Justice League Dark run. I have all the Justice League Dark issues because I loved what Tynan did on the title, and I loved what Ram V did when he came in. So I'll just continue it that way. There's no planet in the DC multiverse, or planet in my own personal multiverse, that exists where I will spend money on a Brian Michael Bendis Justice League book. So, whatever. If they explore this, they explore it. If they don't, they don't. But for me, it just left me cold. The best parts about Ram V on Justice League Dark was always the interaction between the characters. And I felt we didn't get enough of that here. This is really just a demon story. And his characterization, just because of things that have happened, he's felt betrayed and he's been hiding from Merlin. It seems like a different characterization for the demon than we've ever seen before. And so, yeah, the story never clicked for me. I didn't really enjoy it. The main story by Joshua Williamson. Well, lo and behold, what do the members of the Justice League learn at the end of the story? What we knew they were going to learn at the end of the story just from reading the solicits. Hey, it was a bad idea not to be friends and associate outside of just our time being heroes and being members in the league. So again, it felt like a waste of time. The art, I expect more from Robson Rocha. I've seen him do better in the past. I've never been a big fan of the Hyper Clan, and that's not just because they're a Grant Morrison creation. I know people think I hate on Grant Morrison all the time, but they're just a little too, I don't know, I guess maybe because they're white Martians and they can just kind of do whatever they need to do when they need to do it, sort of. It's almost like ex Deus Machina, the villain version. But yet the heroes always still find a way to win. So I don't know. This didn't do anything for me. Again, I just felt like it was, and it wasn't that I thought the first issue was so great that I had expectations. This ended up being exactly what I felt like it would be, which was not a very good story with not very good art, followed by not a very good story, or a story that didn't resonate with me anyway, with not very good art. So yeah, I could go on about specific reasons why I didn't like this, but I just didn't like it. And I'll let the other guys tear it apart if they want, because there's a lot of specific things in the art and in what are supposed to be these character moments from Joshua Williamson that just fall flat. What do you think, Rocky?
Well, starting with the backup, Prophecies by Mark, writer Ram V, artist Marcio Takara. I actually, it reminded me a little bit. It clearly there was reminiscent of Avengers Endgame, the movie, because Dr. Fate, Khalid as Dr. Fate, when he confronts in the helmet the new entity, the Egyptian entity, Haret. I'm pronouncing it wrong, of course, because I always mispronounce names. Haret. Anyway, she tells him many different ways that this could end. He even acknowledges at the end when he's talking to Demon that there's only one future in which we win, and this is not one of them. It has very much like Avengers Endgame. And then he tells Demon, like you said, Jay, so you remember past actions. They may not be past actions may yet be influenced by the future that you have seen. So in other words, this entire story means nothing because it can always change. And they just want to see if people are going to resonate with this story. And of course people aren't, because I don't know what the hell happens. Merlin out of the blue. I don't know. Is it me? But I always thought Merlin should be a good guy because he was, I think, of King Arthur's court. I don't know. I don't understand DC's fascination with making Merlin a bad guy. It's nonsense to me. I think that's just narratively a stupid choice. But in any event, Merlin's a bad guy. He doesn't like Dr. Fate. Dr. Fate ends up making a deal. And because Merlin can't use the helmet of Naboo without Khalid, Khalid agrees if Merlin spares humanity, that Khalid as Dr. Fate will be essentially Merlin's, will work for Merlin in a nutshell. And so that's how that ends. In other words, the good guys lose again, which is in keeping with the depression of Future State. And that's kind of where it's, even the title of the story, I guess I'm not educated very well. Prophecies. I don't even know what that means. Prophecies. What an odd name for a title for a story. But in any event, it was okay. I thought the art was okay. Ram V, I guess you put lipstick on the pig. I've got no interest in knowing how we got to that point at all. It was too convoluted, not enough. Just like Teen Titans, we were dropped in the middle of something and I just really don't care how it ends. And, you know, and again, I mean, how about doing something just a little bit more original? I mean, do you actually expect me to believe? I didn't believe it in Avengers Endgame, and I don't believe it now. I don't believe that out of 14 billion, 4,000 some scenarios, there's only one scenario where you win. That's absolute freaking nonsense. I don't believe it. And it's cliche, it's derivative, and I expect more from a writer who's familiar with pop culture. I'm sorry, Ram V, this was a miss. As for the main story with Justice League, I'm going to disagree with you slightly, Jace, and say, and just play, just kind of be a real jerk here and say that, in fact, Joshua Williamson once again engaged in his tropes, and he did not show that the Justice League is better when they know each other. In fact, he showed the exact opposite. He showed definitively that the Justice League could defeat the Hyper Clan and still not know each other. Joe, the Green Lantern, Joe Mulane, the Far Sector Green Lantern, she defeated her Hyper Clan enemy because of something that they didn't know. John already knew that Batman hums. He could have accomplished the same thing defeating the Hyper Clan without letting the rest of the Justice League know that Batman hums when he fights. Andy already knew that Flash called her princess. She didn't have to reveal that to the rest of the Justice League to defeat the Hyper Clan. None of the revelations that the Justice League members made in this story were show that they need to know each other in order to be an effective Justice League. The entire premise is flawed. He utterly failed to show that. And also, the Flash very easily brought all the Justice League back to Earth Designate Zero. He just had them, he vibrated, he brought them all back to Earth very easily. In other words, they didn't, the conversation they had, the whole setup about how, well, you know, we actually know each other because I've noticed this or I've noticed that. None of the revelations disclosed were necessary for them to defeat the Hyperclan. They would have known, they knew those revelations prior, and they could have defeated them anyway if they had not, even if they hadn't disclosed that to their fellow team members. In fact, the story would have been better had they not. It would have been better had they defeated the Hyperclan and then revealed how, and saying, because even though we don't know each other, I know from past experience that Batman hums when he does this. But they played their hand too soon. So from a writing perspective, narratively, I think Joshua Williamson really blew what could have been a much better story. And in any event, it was adequate. It was okay. I didn't... But it could have been much better. I will say this about the Justice League. We end up with a very diverse Justice League. We got an African, you know, we got a black Batman. We got a female black Green Lantern. We got a Brazilian Wonder Woman. We got a non-binary Flash. We got a white redheaded Aqua Woman. And we got a Kryptonian Superman. What we don't have, thank God, is a white male. That would just be terrible. So, yeah, we got a diverse Justice League. And, you know, again, this can be very exciting, and we'll see where it goes. But in terms of was it absolutely necessary that this Justice League really know each other? No, it really wasn't.
Yeah, fair enough. I guess I was more speaking to at the end, they do sort of come together and realize.
They do. I'm being a dick. I'm being a dick.
Yeah.
Admittedly.
No, but I get what you're saying. Yeah, they don't. I guess they figure, well, this may prevent problems in the future. But no, they defeat the Hyperclan without having to, you know, to actually know. Although he does try through various things to point out during the fight that it's just because of the way it plays out. You know, yeah. Oh, I don't know which is the real one. Oh, you're the only one that calls me princess. So I knew. Good thing that we were friends. You know, I mean, again, it's lazy, stupid fourth grade writing, but that's future state. Yeah. Trevor, you have anything to add?
Yeah, I mean, I generally agree with Rock, although, you know, I don't think that holding somebody accountable for bad work is necessarily being a dick, in which case I'm the biggest dick of them all. So, you know, if I were to summarize this issue.
It's the best friend forever! Best friend forever! Sing!
Yep, that's it. You don't need to buy Future State Justice League, boys and girls. I've just summarized it for you, courtesy of SpongeBob. But aside from that, I generally agree with what Rocky had to say, as consistent with a lot of Williamson, not just Future State, Williamson as a whole. He is spent so much time telling you how to feel rather than making you feel that way. We should feel the camaraderie. Oh, they're all friends. Because they know each other's names. Don't worry. I made sure that on the last page, everybody in the scene said each other's names and had a line of dialogue so that you knew that they were friends. Because, Chase, did you know that we won? Oh, yes, Yara Floor. I knew that we won through the power of friendship. How about you, non-binary Flash? We did it really quick. And then they yell up to Superman on Warworld. They're like, what do you think, Clark? Because we're so tight that I know about his dad. This is the story. It sucks. It's boring. It's tropey. For the life of me, I don't understand why Williamson has been given the reins of the DC universe, but I don't know. I just love her. I wish you guys could see Rocky's face. Why? What about this guy's work has said that this is the guy to lead the DC universe? But granted, they've been making nonsensical decisions for years now. The setup is a trope and a half. The disagreements and the overbaked who's who bickering because we don't trust each other, we're gonna have an argument because we don't know who's who. Like the equally tropey battle of the imposters. It felt like I was watching a horrible kids cartoon. I'm not even shitting on kids cartoons because I'll watch Batman the Animated Series, the Dwayne McDuffie Justice League, any of that stuff any day. This is a bad children's cartoon. It continues to pedestalize the new Justice League by taking things that never happened with the old Justice League and materializing ways to shit on them in order to make this new Justice League look better, even though through Williamson's writing, you can tell how incompetent they are.
John continues to act surprised about, like, for example, Andy Curry's identity. You're telling me John Kent and Andy Curry didn't grow up hanging out? Are you fucking me? John Kent was like, what, 12 years old when Andy was born? We're talking about how tight the Justice League was. John Kent doesn't know who Arthur Curry's daughter is, and vice versa. Are you shitting me? That's the way. I mean, come on. Suspension of disbelief. There's only so far you can go, and that's just nonsensical. What I also don't get is that how is the new Flash claiming to identify where they are through the vibrations? Like, how is that proof of the Flash's identity? They could have just shaken their hand on the ground and said, we were on planet fucking Walmart, and it could have been, you don't know. So that's enough justification to believe that this is the Flash, that for the rest of the team who is so distrusting of everybody, to believe that this is the proper Flash. Sounds pretty dumb to me. It doesn't, especially when this is supposed to be a Justice League who are singularly and individually so great that they all blew their predecessors out of the water, and yet they're all morons. What does that say about the old Justice League now? Come on. Don't shit all over my favorite characters because you want these dolts to look good. You know, it's just super clunky on a narrative level. Dialogue is also equally clunky because Williamson feels the need, not just in that horrible last scene, the just cringy last scene, actually. He feels the need to make every cast member talk when they're on panel when they're on screen together, rather than generating authentic, organic dialogue that has narrative purpose. It's just juvenile, half baked. You can tell that this story just completely and utterly lacks originality. And there's another inconsistency with this Batman. So Batman in Gotham refuses to kill, right? This is something that Rocky has said ample times throughout the course of these reviews, even to the detriment of his own well-being. But this Batman's willing to torch a white Martian alive? You're telling me he's alive after getting blowtorched with something, first of all, made by evil masterminds T.O. Morrow and or Ivo, and you're telling me that white Martian is alive after getting roasted by the Batman? That's the same Batman that's in Gotham? That's the same guy? That's what you're trying to tell me? It doesn't make any sense. It's just, boy, it was horrible. Even like Robson Rocha, again, you know, setting the trend for an artist that I love, just not putting his best foot forward. I'll give him the credit where I think some of these layouts had a lot of energy to them. And he knows what to do with camera, but on a design level, on a kinetic level, not so well done. Regarding the Justice League Dark story, the Justice League book was the last thing that I read. So I didn't finish reading the Justice League Dark story. I got about halfway through it. So I don't want to comment on the story just because I haven't read it, and I feel like I'd be making ignorant comments here, but I can't speak on the art. I did continue to kind of roll through. Visually, I think Marcio Takara's designs were weak, you know, like Jace was kind of alluded to, but I think on a sort of visually narrative level, I actually think Takara is very successful. What he does with camera, what he does with gesture, movement, action, I think is all actually quite well done. I think it's set up and it feels like you're watching something play out on a screen almost. Where things do begin to fall a little bit on their is that facial features are kind of inconsistent. And even when the camera is pulled up close, they don't really have any sort of defining features. You know who they are very sort of vaguely. But if you were to take, for example, I forget who that is in the armor, but that woman and Zatanna, you really wouldn't know that they were different women aside from the color of their hair. So there are a lot of small issues like that. You know, it's again, I can't really comment on the writing. I wasn't super happy with it, or reading the half of it that I did read. It did feel very sort of by the numbers, very sort of cookie cutter. I'm not really like, I don't really give it a hard time for the, you had 14 million chances and this was the only opportunity that you could have had. I mean, I'm suspending my disbelief about, you know, wizards and dragons and demons and a talking monkey, you know, battling each other in a city. I think I can kind of deal with one sort of mathematically improbable statistic, but you know, it's, I mean, I would read this Justice League Dark backup probably five times over before I read the main Justice League story. So, you know, it wasn't great, but what does that tell you as a sort of litmus test for the Justice League story? I suppose that's more purposeful than anything else.
All right, well, let's move on. Last book, Future State Dark Detective number 3, main story written by Mariko Tamaki, art by Dan Mora, Jordy Belair handles the colors, Aditya Bidikar does the letters, and then there is the backup story with Grifter, which is written by Matthew Rosenberg, illustrated by Carmine D. Giandomenico, colors by Antonio Fabella, and letters by Anne World Design. How'd you feel about this, Rocky? Did you like this issue?
I actually did. This was actually my favorite issue, my favorite overall, and in fact, it contains my first and second favorite stories of the week. My first favorite story was Grifter. Now, I think Matthew Rosenberg is a welcome addition to the DC universe as a writer. I think he's one of the better ones. And I'm not saying he's, you know, I thought he had his weaknesses at Marvel, but I like Matthew Rosenberg. I really like his, I think he's just overall, he's a good writer. He's a soldier. I'd call him a soldier. He's not necessarily the one, he's not the Captain America of any particular writing team, but he's a good soldier. He writes good stories. I'm never disappointed with Matthew Rosenberg. He may not hit it out of the park all the time, but he always seems to entertain me. And he certainly does with Grifter. Now the artist Carmine D. Giandomenico, who did the art for the Grifter backup, I thought the art was lacking a little bit. It was very sloppy, but it conveyed enough of the action that the humor and the dialogue that Matthew Rosenberg imbues with the story, I really enjoyed it. I mean, Matthew Rosenberg does such a good job. You know, Grifter is such an a-hole. He's such an a-hole. Nobody likes him. He pisses everybody off. And I thought this story, notwithstanding the art, which I thought could have been better, I thought this story did a really good job of showing that despite the fact that the Grifter is a grade a-hole, he comes through for Huntress and he sacrifices for Huntress and he does the right thing, even though he's not completely 100% a selfish jerk. And I really enjoyed this story. I thought it was great. There was action. It was an adrenaline rush. It was a great car scene, a great chase scene, ending with Grifter betraying Lucius Fox. Lucius Fox paid him, of course. Lucius Fox had an alternative agenda. He made a deal with the magistrate to essentially find and capture the Huntress. And ultimately, he tried to manipulate Grifter into helping him find the Huntress. Then of course that's what happened, and then of course Lucius Fox, while he betrays the Huntress and the Grifter, he does feel sorry for Grifter. He pays off Grifter. Grifter can escape. It ends with Grifter. He could easily escape the magistrate and leave the Huntress to her own fate, but he doesn't. He goes back and rescues her, and he lets her escape while he gets captured by the magistrate. This is something that a great A asshole would not normally do, but Grifter did it, and I really liked it. It had humor. It had fun. The art, I wish, was a little bit better, but it worked for me, and I really enjoyed the rapport and the dialogue between the Huntress and the Cole, so I give that top marks. With the main storyline, Dark Detective with Mariko Tamaki and Dan Mora on the art, Jordy Belair on the colors. Really great job as well, I thought. I don't think the story moved along as much as I would like, but one thing I'll credit Mariko Tamaki for is that, you know, the tone and the overall feel of this story by Mariko Tamaki, it's remained consistent and it's worked. This story really, Batman, Bruce Wayne, this story really embodies the name itself, the Dark Detective. It's perfectly named because this is Bruce Wayne being a detective in all ways that really work. And he's as much Bruce Wayne in figuring stuff out as he is Batman in this Dark Detective series. This is now the third issue. And there's a murder of another billionaire, Gothamite billionaire named Carl Burnington, who was providing surveillance technology to the magistrate. And ultimately he's killed because Carl Burnington, of course, wanted to sell this Carl, I guess Bennington wanted to sell this tech off to other cities and to the government, and they didn't want that. But in any event, Bruce sort of tracks that down, figures that out. He runs into Jace Fox, the next Batman, and they have a healthy respect for each other. And, you know, again, not a lot happens, but one thing that saves it for me is Dan Mora's art, because I actually enjoy just watch the progression. And I never had that appreciation in the first two chapters, but the fact that this is decompressed normally is a high criticism, but Dan Mora's art, I can enjoy the visual journey. And Marika Tamaki, I believe, has a destination in mind. I'm enjoying it. Jordi Belair does a great job on the covers. And overall, this is by far my favorite comic of the week.
All right, Trevor, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, it's definitely no hyperbole that this was by far and away the best of the week. You know, I've been very fond, or at least fairly fond, of Mariko Tamaki's Dark Detective. I think this has been the weakest of the three Dark Detective books we've gotten so far, but by no means is bad. Like Rock said, it was very decompressed. We're getting sort of a very finite segment of plot, and that's pretty much the whole issue. And it leads me to believe, or hope, because please, Mariko Tamaki, don't betray me like this, because I'm beginning to have trust in you as a writer, that this last issue, I feel like it's going to be very tight in the way that she's going to have control of the pace, the tone, and the end of it. So that this issue sort of did need to fill out a little bit of space in order to get her to a place where she feels like she can deliver the best final issue. Now, again, that's only speculation. I could be totally wrong. The next issue could be incredible. It could be worse than this. You never know. Artistically, I think Dan Mora gets a little bit looser in this issue than he was in the last two, but nonetheless is still by far and away the best art coming out of the DC Future State books. Dan Mora is a master of camera. He is a master of composition. I mean, even his aesthetic design, even when it's looser than what he's normally putting out, it's still better. It's still incredible. It's still so, so good. And Jordi Belair's colors just really match off well, delivering, you know, this sort of neo-futuristic Gotham with all of these neon lights, but also she knows when to pare down in these smaller scenes and when to dull out the colors a little bit and how to draw focus. Visually, just a stunning issue. I mean, seriously, Dan Mora knows how to put a page together and how to tell a story sequentially. And it is a testament to him because, like Rock said, not much really happens in this issue, and you kind of read it and you're like, man, there's visually a lot happening. So it almost tricks you into thinking that you go through more plot than you actually do, even though it's segmented. And what I will give Tamaki credit for is that there's nothing like in this issue that is inherently bad. You know, it's just not a lot happens, but everything that does happen is pretty well done. There's a good sort of delivery of exposition in terms of Bruce Wayne playing the detective and us sort of causally sort of parsing out what's going on in Gotham and the sort of mystery that he's trying to solve here. I will say something that has continued to get sort of worse and worse with these issues of Tamaki is that her internal voice for Batman becomes more and more sort of conversational, and that's not my Batman. And that could just be a me thing. You know, Bruce kind of, you go through these pages and there's a lot of sort of boisterous rhythm to the way that he's talking and in the cadence. And it's not like it's just generally bad dialogue. It just doesn't feel like Bruce, especially a Bruce that's kind of down on his luck and struggling in his mission, you know, and in his personal life. It's just, it doesn't, to me, Batman dialogue should also always be very sharp and very to the point. And this is a little bit less so, but you know, if that's the big criticism here, I guess, you know, it's she's doing a pretty good job, and hopefully she can rein that in, because I'm big when it comes to narrative voice. I think dialogue and showing characterization through voice is big for me, mostly because I read comics with an interior voice. Like when I read Batman, I hear Kevin Conroy. So if I hear Kevin Conroy's voice saying something and it doesn't sound like Batman to me, it's immediately going to sort of trigger off an alarm. But that's less of an objective critique and more just me and my taste as a Batman reader. I do look forward to the next issue. I will say that the moment the next Batman popped up on the screen, like, I audibly said, "Oh, Bruce, kick his ass. Like, just do it. Get this done with. Let's be done with this next Batman stuff." But, you know, unfortunately we didn't quite get that. And I felt like that moment in terms of the writing could have been a little bit more dynamic, but Dan Mora definitely pulls all the weight and visually just makes this an incredible looking confrontation. You could have taken away all of the word balloons and the internal monologue boxes, and it would have looked great. So overall, you know, the Dark Detective was fine, made better by Dan Mora. The Grifter story I thought was pretty okay. It's a fun romp. You know, if you just want something to kind of have a good time and kind of, you know, it's not something to write home about. It doesn't have, you know, like it does play on some very sort of basic themes. It really felt like in a way almost like a Michael Mann movie, but with Grifter. And, you know, Michael Mann is Michael Mann, so I'm not terribly mad about that. The dialogue for Grifter, courtesy of Rosenberg, feels very full of personality and carries an organic cadence, which I like. He does sort of play off of people well, and it makes me interested in Cole Cash as somebody who never really got into the Wildstorm books very much. And there's a good symbiosis between Rosenberg and artist Carmine John Domenico, between the art and the plotting, because it feels action-packed, and the sort of chase scene feels fast and loud and just full of energy. There are some sort of logistical questions that I have here, primarily with, like, for example, you know, we know that Luke Fox is sort of being forced to help the magistrate because they've sort of got him by the balls, but I don't think that makes a lot of sense. One, because assumedly he stopped being Batwing before the magistrate ever came, so therefore it was before the magistrate had those micro drones that could figure out people's identity and learn everything about them before they could even realize it. He's also the son of the guy that's providing and arming the magistrate, and the son of the woman that is trying to legitimize the magistrate. So I can't help but feel like that wouldn't fly for them to arrest him and give him an ultimatum to help them out. It just doesn't make a lot of sense, and that could be an editorial thing. It could be a Rosenberg thing. We really will never know. You know, there's a lot of sort of nice energy to the story in terms of the action. John Domenico's art is surprisingly tight compared to his normal work, although I think that without the colors being so sort of saturated and I don't want to say monotone, but they're very, very singular, so that everything stands out very well. I can't help but feel like John Domenico's art would not feel anything more than two dimensional. So I give the colorist a lot of credit, although I feel like if they were coloring a little bit more conscious penciler, they wouldn't have to make some of those sort of overly saturated color choices, but you know, you do what you have to do with what you're given. You know, overall it was fine. It was a fine story. I don't hate it. I think in the sort of space of this week's Future State, it is it's kind of a shining light, if I'm to be honest. And I do have one question. I do get kind of annoyed, and this isn't a John Domenico or a Matt Rosenberg thing. This is a DC thing. Are we doing White Huntress or are we doing Dark Skin Huntress? What are we doing? I don't care which one you do, but can we just stick with one? I don't understand that.
Yeah. Whatever. Depends on the colorist, I guess. I was disappointed in this book. Mostly because I kind of felt like the previous Dark Detective issues were pretty good. Like you yourself said, Trevor, this is the weakest of the three we've gotten so far. And I really enjoyed the first chapter of the Grifter story, and this one left me cold. So, you know, I wasn't necessarily looking forward to this for the Dark Detective or the Batman story. I was more looking forward to it for Grifter because I thought the first part was so good, and this I just felt let down. So ultimately, it was a disappointment for me. That being said, it's still the best book of the week, but I'd give it a 4. So when a 4 is your best book of the week, it's like, man, yeah, this is my lowest score by far when we get to the overall, and it's low. I'm telling you guys, it's low.
So wait, you would give the whole book between Dark Detective and Grifter a 4, or just the Grifter story?
No, the whole book is a 4 for me. It's a little below average. I felt that, yeah, the decompressed storytelling in the first one, it left me cold. Nothing happened. And maybe I still give it a 5 at that point. But the other part, the thing that I didn't like at all was, you know, here it is. She's going through the motions. Tamaki's going through the motions. We're not getting advancement of plot. We're not, you know, even though we're getting this internal dialogue and from Bruce and supposedly this insight into his thoughts, he's not saying anything. It's like, move the story forward. Give me some insight into how, you know, what he's thinking. Bruce is so analytical. It's right there in the title, Dark Detective. Give me some of that. But instead, no, you're going to waste panel space giving me fan service of Dark Detective Bruce Wayne meeting Jace Fox, the next Batman. There's no reason for that to be in there at all, other than the fact, hey, I get a cool Lee Bermejo cover of them facing off against each other, because it doesn't serve any point. I didn't like it. I was like, if they team up, or it happened organically, but it felt shoehorned in. And so that ultimately is a lot. I'm going to knock a whole point out for that. So I didn't like that. You guys have more than said, you know, the other things that I didn't like about it, but I just took that. I think it hit me more because I did have expectations. And the same thing goes for the Grifter story. I didn't understand, like you were talking about, Trevor, why Luke Fox, all of a sudden we're going to flip Luke Fox around, and I'm a fan of Luke Fox. I loved the Nightwing, the New 52 Nightwing series, especially the stuff that Jimmy Palmiotti and Justin Gray did. And
you mean Batwing?
Batwing, yeah, sorry, Batwing, Luke Fox's character. And yeah, so I didn't like that he was the bad guy. I didn't like, once again, that at the end, it's not the end, with Grifter himself saying, this is not the end. You know, they're going to go throw him in Blackgate or whatever, and story to be continued in Future State Gotham. No, I didn't like the tropey fact that, yeah, to Rocky's point, he lets Huntress escape and not himself. And it's great. It shows that deep down, as much as Cole Cash is an asshole, he does have heroic tendencies. Great. But it's still a totally cliched ending.
Yeah.
I agree with you on the art for Dijon Domenico. Thicker lines. Like, if you just go and look at the line work, the line weight, I should say, that Fabella, I have to imagine Fabella enhanced it just to give it that firmness and take away the scratchiness that's sort of inherent in Dijon Domenico's art. And it there's a consequence to that. When you increase the line weight, the art loses something. It ends up looking very static and very heavy. And it kind of works here, only because it, you know, this isn't a flash story, and that's where I've seen Dijon Domenico's art work many, many times before. And there, you couldn't do this on a flash book. It had these thick line weights. It would really not work. But here it works okay, but it's still not, you know, his best work. And it ultimately left me cold. I thought the first Grifter story was really enjoyable. And this was sort of you know, high speed chase that ultimately didn't end up with a satisfying conclusion, because now I'm expected to go read more of Future State Gotham, and I don't want to do that. So yeah, I just didn't care for it. But the color work is good by Fabella. I'll give him that. And Jordy Belair's color work, and Dan Moore's art. I didn't say anything about Dan Moore's art in the first story. Yeah. Visually great. Like, the scenes we're getting of this future Gotham are very interesting, very colorful. It almost reminds me of Minority Report, like this, just because all the advertising is just over the top, which you could totally see happening. But and the scene with Bruce kind of standing there overlooking the city, and this sort of you know, less superheroic and more kind of urban tactical bat suit is pretty interesting as well. But yeah, nothing much happens. And I just hated that scene that was shoehorned in there with Jason Bruce meeting up. So,
you know, I was just thinking about John Domenico's art. You know what I realize is so kind of off-putting? If you take a good look at it, the line weights for the stuff in the foreground are just as heavy as the line weights for the stuff in the background. And I think that's where you lose a lot of depth, because normally what a line weight will do is help to bring something forward because you're adding black to its outline, right? So it pushes everything inside the black forward. And what's happening here is that if you look at any of these scenes with backgrounds, all of the backgrounds, the line weights are just as thick. The details on the face or in the costumes are just as thick as the outline. So it makes everything feel so sort of flat and two-dimensional.
Yeah, but he's always had that.
No, I'm not saying it's exclusive. I'm just saying I think that's why it feels so 2D.
I'm sure he's done it at times, but I can't ever remember seeing him vary his line weights in that way. But you're exactly right. That's what's supposed to happen. But yeah. I think typically he doesn't do that. So
yeah.
Anyway, like I said, worst week for me, 2.5 overall. Like I added them all up and it only comes out to a 2.5. It's even lower than I expected. I'm giving Green Lantern a 1. Only because I won't go down to 0, because, you know, people did make an effort. But a lot of these books are, you know, 2s, 3s. For me, there's not a single 5 in the bunch. So when you add it all up for these 7 books, you know, yeah, there's not a single book this week to me that was an average comic, you know, 5 out of 10. Dark Detective, I think, was probably the best, and I would only give it a 4. So I don't know. Maybe I'm being overly critical because I saw that giant stack of my books and I thought about all the money I wasted. But this week was the worst week since week one, and I think the worst week overall that we've had. So what did you think, Rocky? What did you would you score it?
Yeah, I think overall I'd give it probably a 5.5, maybe 5.7. You know, the dark, you know, again, there were some stories there that maybe I'm a little interested about. I like Teen Lantern. I think Dark Detective is still interesting, and you know, really, yeah, I'm just hoping for, I'd really like to see Infinite Frontier in March really hit it out of the park. I don't think it's going to, although I will say though, I never mentioned this earlier when I spoke, that there is a reference to, it should be mentioned that in the Justice League, Williamson did mention that the Hyper Clan is going to be imprisoned on Earth Omega, and Earth Omega is actually, that's a spoiler. Earth Omega, we only know about the Elseworlds. Earth Omega is actually the opposite. That's that secret planet opposite of the Elseworlds. So that was actually spoiled here. Although, again, because it's such a convoluted narrative, nobody is paying attention to it. But I only got that from a interview with Williamson, that Earth Omega is actually the opposite of this mysterious Elseworlds that is now the new center of the DC universe. So that's something to keep in mind. That's curious. Exactly what is Earth Omega? Exactly what is Earth Elseworlds? This Elseworlds, don't really know. We'll have to check out. We'll have to check out with hopefully some excitement, God forbid, Infinite Frontier issue 0.
Trevor, what do you score it?
This week was a 2 for me. I'm not as harsh on Dark Detective than Jace was. You know, I'd say Dark Detective, just like the main Dark Detective story, is probably like a 7. I mean, you know, I give, you know, out of 10, 5 points art, 5 points writing. Sometimes I'll give writing a little bit more credit just because I'm a biased writer. But, you know, I think Dan Mora put in a lot of work artistically, and, you know, I didn't hate what Tamaki did, but there just wasn't a lot there. So I think that's kind of what saved this from being like a 1, to be honest with you. And Grifter was just kind of very cookie cutter Michael Mann. Obviously, I had my questions to ask about it that just logistically didn't make sense.
A 1. Come on.
He gave it a 2.5. You're poking at me giving it a 1. Listen, just because I'm not so desperate for DC that I won't put lipstick on a pig, dog.
Come on, a one out of 10.
I just said I gave it a 2 out of 10. I said it, without Dark Detective, this would have been a 1 out of 10. That's for sure.
Well, but, well, I figure if it makes it out of the printing press, it's at least a 0.5. I mean, come on.
That's debatable. That's debatable. But this is, it, you know, it was a poor week. A lot of inconsistencies. You know, the shining, like the second best story of the week was a story where actually the two best stories of the week, almost nothing happened. The Venditti story where nothing happened, and the Dark Detective where not much happened. The thing I'll give it credit for is that last page sting where you realize that they've still been tracking Bruce after he thought that he dismantled the drone. Is a good little bit of tension to build leading into the last issue. And it does still keep me, you know, interested in the fourth one. By the way, Dark Detective is going to be the only DC Future State book that I haven't dropped at any point. I've dropped every single other DC Future State book between issues at some point, except for Dark Detective. So that's got to say something.
Well, I'll say this. If I hadn't read any Future State and I picked up these 7 titles and I read them, there's not a single book I would go back. Now I know a lot of these don't have a third issue, but let's just assume that I just picked up these DC books and these were the, you know, DC series that were ongoing. There's not a single one of these books where I would pick up the next issue. None. I would not spend my money on any of these books with these creative teams telling these stories going forward. And so, you know, no surprise, I'm not picking up Future State Gotham City. I'm not picking up, you know, Teen Titans Academy. I'm not picking up Green Lantern. I'm not picking up Justice League. I haven't decided if I'm picking up Tamaki or Tamaki and Dan Moore's Detective yet. I might. I don't know. But yeah, their books are just not good, man. So anyway, let's wrap up. Why don't we tell everybody where they can find you? We'll start with you, Boom.
Well, I can be found at my YouTube channel, Comic Boom, with an exclamation mark, and I can be found on Twitter at Metropolis40.
And you, Trevor?
You can find me on YouTube at Dark Knight Nation, on Twitter at Dark Knight NAT25. If you want something that's a little bit less emblazoned with anger and frustration and where I am not so emotional and maybe you want to see me making comics, you can follow me at Pocket Watch Press on Twitter. And by the time this airs, I think the Kickstarter campaign to the second issue of Area 51, the Helix Project, will have gone live. So I'm sure I'll leave that to Jace to throw in the show notes when it does go live, but please consider giving it a look. It is a deeply personal story. And I can at least promise that it's better than everything we read this week from DC Future State. So if you bought DC Future State this week and you're ready for a step up, come my way.
That's right. He guarantees at least a 2.5.
At least a 2.5.
In order to have a 2, if Dark Detective, just for the sake of argument, Dark Detective is a 7, we give the other books a 1. So, and then we divide by the number of books, comes out to 1.85. So literally give everything a 1, except Dark Detective gets a 2. And that's how you come up with your 2.0. Or there could be one other book in there that's a 2. But
yeah, I mean,
you're not so far away from where I am. You know, I'm giving Dark Detective like a 3, and everything else gets a 2 or a 1. It's just bad.
Believe it or not, some of these books got 0s.
I won't give a book a 0. I'm kind of like Rocky. If it makes it off the printing press, it's, you know, it's a 5. people put effort. It's a 0.5. I mean, is it possible? So the lowest CGC grade I've ever seen is a 0.5, but it's possible to go lower than that. Isn't that correct?
Well, I'm sure. Like, probably, from what I've seen, a 0.5 would be like a ripped off cover that's beaten to death. What if the cover was then ripped in half? Like, would you go below a 0.5?
I don't know. I held an Amazing Spider-Man 0.5 that belonged to Norm Ratman once. That was cool. But, Yeah, it's. I'm sure somebody online will tell us. Maybe there's point ones out there, or we could just go to the CG census and figure it out. But I mean, I don't go below. I mean, a one is probably about as low as I'll go. I imagine it's possible to give a zero if I read something that I felt like the person was purposely not trying.
Did you read the Jeffrey Thorne Green Lantern story?
I did, and clearly I disliked it. But the guy put out effort to create his fan fiction, so. I give him a one. I give him a 0.5 for that, and I give Rainey a 0.5. Plus, it had the Venditti story. Andy Tong had good art in there, so you know I got to give some credit where credit is due. But yeah, it was a let's face it, everybody. It was a rough week. We hope that you found some joy in it, or you know maybe I'm still seeing people online that are loving this stuff. Now,
I want whatever crack they're smoking.
Well, yeah. That being said, I see a lot more people disliking Future State than I do see people liking it. But there are people out there that are enjoying it. One more thought, and we'll wrap up. I even saw somebody that said, "You know, I don't know what DC is thinking, bringing a writer on Green Lantern who hates Hal Jordan. I won't be buying it." And then somebody responded to them and said, "That's exactly the reason I'm picking it up. I also dislike Hal Jordan." And this is the one thing DC could do to get me to pick up a Green Lantern book is put a writer on there who doesn't like Hal Jordan. So maybe DC's going after that anti-Hal Jordan crowd. Is it a big readership? Probably not, but I guess we'll find out. So anyway, listeners, thanks for hanging in with us. We've made it all the way to the end of us really being disappointed in these books. We thank you for the support as always, and we'll talk to you next time.
You can find the Comic Source Podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, or whichever podcasting app you prefer. Please tell all your friends about us, subscribe, and rate us. The ratings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on Apple. Also be sure to visit us at lrmonline.com to join the conversation, access the show notes, and discover all our other great pop culture content. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. So once again, we want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.